But also today, let's talk science. And with me is someone who's no stranger now to this program because he was talking only last week with Angela Owens while I was away. His name is Adam Bumpus. He's from the University of Melbourne. He's a geographer working there. He's a research fellow from there. And he happens to be a 2016 scientist in residence in RN. Andrew, you haven't left the studio then?
No, I've been here. Since last week. Yeah, 24 hours a day, the whole time.
Well,
yeah.
I'm glad you were able to stay because Bernie's just buggered off and left us with you, which is fantastic because we know you're better.
She literally dropped the mic.
Yeah, she did. Yeah. And just ran like a hare. And so Bernie's actually away on break for about a month. So, Adam, when it comes to Neanderthals and us, the Homo sapien, we've always been sort of top of the ladder when it comes to our survival against them. But new science emerging in the last few days suggests that there's another layer to why it is we're superior. Tell us all about it.
Absolutely. It's always been one of these really interesting questions. Why do humans exist on Earth and we don't have any Neanderthals left or any other hominin species? And there are a few reasons why this has happened. A few reasons relate to the size of our brains. And they had very big brains as well, but they did not have as big a part of the brain that we have for complex decision making.
Right.
So humans were able to make better decisions or more complex decisions. And we were also able to perhaps have more complex language. Neanderthals could talk and grunt a little bit. They could communicate in some ways. They buried their dead, for example. So it indicates they had some complex language, but not as complex as humans.
Okay.
And so there's these reasons why we kind of outcompeted them. But some new science has come out that's shown how humans might have outcompeted Neanderthals because we're more tolerant to smoke. So more tolerant to smoke from fires, more tolerant to smoke from cooking. And this has come from a genetic mutation that scientists have recently published in Molecular Biology and Evolution that says we as humans have this genetic trait that Neanderthals and other apes that we see on the planet now do not have.
Now, the reason why this is interesting is because I think we know that there are toxins in smoke, but in fact, some of these toxins are so lethal that potentially they could cut down our longevity on Earth.
Absolutely. And this happens for humans as well, of course.
It does.
Breathing in too much smoke. But for the Neanderthals, it meant that the female Neanderthals would likely have problems with giving birth and or higher infant mortality because they weren't they couldn't accept the smoke as well as humans could.
Wow.
Because they didn't have the genetic mutation.
So there were a more propensity of birth defects, miscarriage, etc.
Exactly. And this exposure for these expectant mothers for the Neanderthal species was really serious. And of course, that has a major play on the population. But the other part is that as Neanderthals also used fire, both humans and Neanderthals used fire. But their ability to deal with it was less. So as humans used fire to cook and started to enable their society to get more complex, then Neanderthals couldn't quite keep up. So there's an evolutionary advantage there for humans. There's an edge that's given to them to slowly but surely become a bigger population than the Neanderthals.
And therefore, because our bodies were more attuned to hanging around with fire and in the presence of smoke, we were able to survive. And therefore, as we talked about only yesterday on the program, we saw some populations across the world, including our own indigenous populations of this country, using fire as a tool to farm.
Absolutely, yes. And this has become a really important part of the way people manage the land. A colleague of mine at the University of Melbourne, Michael Fletcher, he's just got some brand new data. This is hot off the press data from Western Victoria, where he's shown 3,000 years ago that humans altered the fire regime landscape here in Victoria as well. And so before, the climate and fire would match each other. So when the climate was hot, the fires would come. And when humans got to a certain population, that decoupled. And so we could see when humans got to a certain population, they started to work with the land in a different way. And we can show this from 3,000 years ago just here in Australia.
And I think there are various reasons for that, things like hazard reduction burning, but also using that to clear land for pasture where they could then in some ways harvest kangaroos and other animals that fed on that pasture.
Correct. And you can increase biodiversity through this as well.
Right.
So through sort of, it's called mosaic effect in ecology. And you have some areas which are growing larger and some areas which are burning down. Mm-hmm. And that can you create a diversity in the landscape, and that's what creates and helps biodiversity.
Well, let's move on from that, Adam, to our next story, which is in some ways related, and that is there's always been, I think, this preconception amongst most scientists that when it comes to farming and agrarian technology, that ability to stay put in one place and cultivate land and grow a more reliable source of food, often, you know, crops that involve some kind of lentils or pulses or beans, meant that populations could expand, consolidate, and then continue to grow. Is
yes.
that still the knowledge we still have?
You know, it's kind of two ways. There's sort of two different hypotheses for this. The first hypothesis is that as populations grow, we become more, we put more pressure on our resources, and so yeah. then we have to domesticate more to survive. The second hypothesis is that in times of plenty, we have the opportunity to manipulate and play with the environment a bit to sort of figure out how to make them domesticated. What's happened in some recent science that came out a few days ago from the US, from Utah, they looked at the ancestral past in North America. They looked at archaeological finds and they carbon dated things they found in these archaeological sites. So it's a really interesting anthropological study on this. And they carbon dated it to figure out that actually about 5,000 years ago, there was a population spike before there was the domestication of certain food groups, certain plants. So this showed that actually the population had gone up. It actually then spurred pressure on the landscape. So they then started to domesticate things that we still have now, like yams and...
How interesting. Yeah. So in fact, it was the spike in population that prompted an emergency sort of change in behavior.
Yes. It's nowadays, or people have called this for a couple of hundred years, sort of Malthusian approach. This means that Thomas Malthus, the old English reverend, came up with this idea that if population gets bigger, we have to figure out how to solve it. Otherwise, we all die.
Right.
Now, of course, that doesn't really quite work in the modern day. But in this case, back in 5,000 years ago in North America, this was the case. And so the population grew larger and it got to a certain level where they said, we've got to domesticate. They're wild species. These aren't, we're not thinking about massive fields of crops here. This isn't agriculture. This is domestication, which is like the precursor to agriculture.
Right.
But it's really interesting because then people start to live near the fields where these things are happening. And then we start to see society start to build. So it starts to become more sedentary. And it's really interesting because this piece of work shows that it's this one hypothesis, perhaps in this case, more than the other. It's the hypothesis that we have to, the population was, they had to then start domesticating these plants.
And I can't but help feel sorry for any Neanderthals that wouldn't have been left by then anyway. But if they had been watching, they're going, so they can deal with fire better than we can. And now look at them. What are they doing now? They're organising themselves around a paddock.
And they're having a great chat about it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
in an abstract way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what did you just say to me? Because you just grunted. I have no idea what that was about.
Exactly. Let's move on. Yeah, that's it. We're done.
So began RN Afternoons.
Yes.
From the Neanderthal bloodlines. It's come through to this.
That was it.
We're the last surviving members.
We are, yes. Having ginger hair. Actually, most Neanderthals were ginger as well, apparently.
Are you serious?
Apparently, there's a high proportion that were ginger. Yes. I'll have to corroborate that for next time. But yeah, so anyway, having a ginger hair, maybe that's
well, it. I think you've become highly evolved then. You've done very well. Adam, it's been really good to talk to you. Thank you very much, Michael.
Great to talk.
Adam Bumpus, who is the RN scientist in residence, one of six, even though it's a top five under five. Don't even ask me to explain that because I still don't get it. But it's wonderful to have scientists like Adam on board with RN. They've just finished their sort of internship with RN in the last couple of weeks, but Adam will be in and around the station and the network in times to come. But in other parts of his role, he's a geographer and a senior research fellow working at the intersection of technological innovation studies and economic geography on the role of technology in climate change solutions. So he's kind of important, I reckon, even though he is a redheaded Neanderthal.